A new survey reveals troubling divisions in America when it comes to the question of race. We'll tell you about it just ahead. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, why Black and white Americans see race relations so differently. We want your calls and comments. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, new treatment at Baptist Health offers hope for patients suffering from severe depression. We'll tell you about this cutting-edge treatment. Plus, the Blood Alliance needs your donation, but they're sweetening the deal. They've got a great offer for you this month. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, in the year following the death of Michael Brown, America has seen its share of racial disquiet. The August 9th, 2014 shooting death of the black teen at the hands of a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked weeks of protest and drew attention to a brand new civil rights campaign for the modern era, Black Lives Matter. Now, the organization and the phrase itself has been the center of controversy and tension since it gained nationwide attention last year. Candidates on the 2016 presidential campaign trail have stumbled at times trying to find the perfect pitch to address Black Lives Matter. On the evening of June 17th this year, America once again was forced to confront racial tensions with the mass shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in downtown Charleston, South Carolina, nearly a year after Brown's death. Against this backdrop, PBS NewsHour and Marist College's Institute for Public Opinion conducted a survey of Americans that illustrates the contrast in opinions along racial lines about the opportunities available today for African Americans. And the results point to a large difference in attitudes when it comes to opportunity and race relations among white and black Americans. This morning, we take a closer look as we welcome Dr. Jeffrey N. Wilder, UNF Associate Professor of Sociology and a nationally quoted analyst on issues of race. She's on the line now. Dr. Wilder, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Melissa?
Great, thanks. Thanks for joining us. And here's our question to callers. Why do you think white and black Americans see race so differently? Give us a call with your thoughts. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And Dr. Wilder, PBS and the Marist Institute collaborated on this poll, as I said, against a backdrop of several tragic recent events. The shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, the shooting at the church in Charleston, and other events.
Absolutely. So we can even take it back a step further to think about the genesis of the Black Lives Matter slogan, and that movement started, in the aftermath of, George Zimmerman's acquittal and the death of Trayvon Martin. So we think about things that have been happening over the past year, but really this has really been gaining ground over the past several years.
Let's talk about some of the results. Here are a few results from the poll on the topic of whether African Americans and whites have the same opportunity in getting a job. 76% of African Americans say they do not. 52% of whites say they do. Big disconnect.
Huge. The gulf is wide and it's getting wider. So it's so much more than just this notion of race and justice and police brutality. What this poll kind of shows us is that even when thinking about, what America is supposed to represent, equal opportunity and justice for all, we see that there is a huge gap as far as perceptions related to just individuals' ability to do something as simple and basic as getting a job.
All right. And here's another result on whether African Americans and whites have the same opportunity in equal justice, criminal justice. 87% of African Americans say they do not. 50% of whites say they did. That's an even bigger gap.
Yeah, and that particular one is not as surprising given what we've seen with, everything from the death of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Freddie Gray, many of the folks who've been impacted that we've seen in the media being on the wrong side of, criminal justice and race and policing have been African Americans. So it is no surprise that, the vast majority of African Americans do not see that same opportunity. It becomes less, it's not as clear to white Americans.
And on the issue of Black Lives Matter, 65% of African Americans think the movement focuses on issues of racial justice. Only 25% of white Americans think so. 59% of whites think it distracts attention from the real issues. Black Lives Matter is controversial. Dr. Wilder.
It is. And so if you think about Black Lives Matter, which a lot of social scientists really are examining as a contemporary post-civil rights, you know, social movement. So in the same way that people looked at what was happening in the 60s, we look to the Black Lives Matter as this contemporary movement. But the big difference is that obviously a lot of the fuel behind Black Lives Matter, it began on social media. And so I think a lot of folks don't necessarily think about that as having a lot of weight as being connected to a movement. And the other big piece is that, you know, the center of the Black Lives Matter movement are a lot of young people, a lot of millennials. And also, there are a lot of things about the Black Lives Matter movement that's not necessarily polite. It's very much in your face. These are the issues, you know, demanding justice, rightfully so. And so I think the way in which it's presented as a reactionary, it's not completely, you know, it's not a movement wrapped in anger. It's a movement wrapped in trying to really get justice and immediately. And so I think because of that and the way in which, you know, it's presented, you've got some people who don't necessarily recognize that as a true movement.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment on this new poll. Looking at the disconnect between white and black Americans on issues of race, the number to join the show is 549-2937. Let's talk for a little bit about the 2016 presidential election. 56% of African Americans, 31% of whites think the issue of race relations has been given too little attention. 33% of whites and 19% of African Americans think it's been given too much. So on any topic you care to name, Dr. Wilder, people aren't on the same page.
No, and you can't sidestep it, particularly when you think about the 2016 election and who's running. You know, race issues either have been completely sidestepped by a lot of the candidates, or you have in the instance of you know, candidates like Donald Trump, who continue to get themselves in hot water for making really terribly racially insensitive comments. So I think because the Black Lives Matter movement and issues of race and policing and justice are at the forefront of our nation's social problems, it has to be at the forefront of political issues. But I think the tough part is that we don't see a lot of the candidates who are seeking office really addressing it in the way in which people would like to see.
Let me ask you about a recent piece written on the progressive website, The Daily Beast, by an African-American writer, John McWhorter. It's titled, mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter is Living in the Past. And he writes, yes, black lives taken by cops matter, but so do black lives taken by other blacks. BLM won't win over America, he writes, until it acknowledges this. What about that argument?
Well, and you know, John McWhorter, you know, great, you know, scholar, but very, very conservative in his viewpoints, and he always has been. So he really is one of the individuals who really buy into and encourage and embrace this idea of a meritocracy, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and really kind of thinking about things in a very individualistic type of manner, and fails to really recognize and discuss enough about the things happening institutionally. So absolutely, that's always been a concern for people in the African-American community, the loss of life through violence. And so I think that's a huge concern. I think more people are even more concerned because we continue to see, it almost seems like, you know, every time you turn around, we are continuing to see another story of some African-American losing their life at the hands of folks who are supposed to protect and serve. And so in a number of ways, that is the reason why the Black Lives Matter movement has gained so much foreground. It's not to say that those other things aren't important. They are important. But, you know, you can't turn a blind eye to people who are losing their lives at the hands of people who are supposed to protect and look out for people in the community.
What do you think the recipe is for bringing people together? Because as these poll results show, white Americans are far more likely to focus on numbers showing that African Americans are more likely to be killed by another person of color than a white police officer. Although, as you point out, there are plenty of instances of police officers killing unarmed African Americans. as you study these issues and you conduct workshops trying to bring people together, Jacksonville's Human Rights Commission for years now has been conducting mm-hmm. study circles in this community, trying to get people to put themselves in the other person's shoes and understand another person's point of view. What do you think the way forward is on that in this community and across this country?
You know, that's a really tough question because I think a lot of things that we typically sort of fall back on aren't necessarily working anymore. So trying to put ourselves in other folks' shoes, trying to think about how these issues impact people who don't look like us or who aren't from the same walks of life, those things just aren't working anymore. And I think the first thing is this acceptance that there really is an issue, that we really are at an impasse, that, you know, again, to see that race relations is at the lowest point in recent history is very sobering and it's very bleak given that it's 2015. You know, it's not 1965. It's not even 1985. And so I think we do need to think of some very creative ways to think about talking, not past each other, but really trying to talk to each other and find common ground. This is a tough question because I face this a lot of the times in the classroom when discussing these kinds of issues, particularly among, you know, millennials and younger people from younger generations. They really are hard-pressed to find ways to really move beyond the conflict. And I think part of that is because a lot of people don't really see the issues being as significant as they really are. If it doesn't impact you in your everyday life, it can become very difficult to really understand what people are going through.
Let's go to your calls right now, 549-2937. Jay in Brunswick. Jay up in Brunswick. Hi, Jay. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if your guest would speak to the fact that Black Lives Matter is actually not a one central unit, meaning that each state has a local Black Lives Matter. So there's multiple different acts and actions across the country. And I think the media is viewing it as one unit with one act and one form of action or process that they're going through. Would she speak to the divide, I guess, within Black Lives Matter and how do we overcome that?
Well, I think you bring up a good point, and I appreciate you mentioning that, Jay, that, you know, of course, thinking about how Black Lives Matter started, it started with three women who were, were very outraged at the Zimmerman verdict, and that grew. And so in order for things to take shape and take hold, we've seen in more contemporary times things really developing and gaining traction on social media, but then that leads to grassroots activism and organization within local communities. And so that really is how a number of these issues continue to take shape. I mean, we've seen just in Jacksonville with the Jacksonville 19, a group of local activists trying to, advocate and stand up against these very kinds of issues, very, very issues. And then we've seen, you know, how that impacts ourselves here in Jacksonville. So to have, to stop traffic and to do things to call attention to the movement didn't really get the same type of reaction here in Jacksonville that it did in D.C. and in Baltimore and in other places in Missouri and New York City. So I think we do need to recognize that it takes different things in different locations. At the core of the Black Lives Matter movement is the same thing. It's about justice. I'm really trying to advocate and advance justice as it relates to, specifically the criminal justice system. So absolutely, you're going to have, in order for the movement to really gain traction, you do need to have people in local areas, really trying to advance the cause in communities the same way that we've seen other political organizations for 100-plus years doing the same kinds of things.
Josh is calling from downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Josh. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I was noticing having to do with the percentages, having to do with perspective. Coming from a white guy, the biggest turnoff for me is we definitely need Black Lives Matter. We need this, except for the fact that when you put someone like Mike Brown right on the front, it was quite obvious that he was doing some very despicable stuff. And that's one of the largest things to do with the turnoff when you take and you lump in the criminals with a just thing. You know, Jesus Christ didn't go around robbing stores and punching people in the face. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't hear much about it. And to actually differentiate between the culture that brings this type of behavior, and it's quite obvious to a lot of white folks. I'm not racist whatsoever. I have family that's black. I sympathize, but the biggest thing is that the rap culture is very, very obvious. And if you just listen to the radio for long enough, you can get a good idea that this isn't productive. You know, life isn't all about making a dollar, give me a dollar, and that's the end of it. No, it has to be something deeper than that. And I know that there are so many black individuals who agree. You know, you really can't roll on the player lifestyle and actually have a good, decent community come of it, because there's more than that. You know, there's work ethics, and the main thing is to separate from the straight up criminal. You can't take something serious if it's so obvious that, hey, Charlie Manson was a good guy. No, he wasn't. Everybody knows he wasn't. So that's it. So,
Dr. Wilder.
You know, the most difficult thing I have about that particular comment is that, you know, when people talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, they are very quick to make judgments about the type of individuals that people were who lost their lives. Well, my question to the caller and to other people is this: what about the 9 people who died in June in Charleston? None of those folks were criminals. They were at Bible study. So I guess I have a really hard time. Their lives are gone as well. We can't sit and make judgments against people or make conditions on a movement based upon whose life is lost and whose life gets sacrificed. Trayvon Martin was not a criminal. Jordan Davis was not a criminal. So you can't place it on, rap music or quote-unquote a player lifestyle, because is that the same type of lifestyle that caused Dylann Roof to go out and murder 9 people senselessly? That's part of the issue. That's the reason why there's this huge gap, is I think that people who aren't impacted on a regular basis by this always search for the most extreme, most individualistic ways in which to dilute the movement. The movement is here, and the movement continues because people are continuing to die, whether that's at the hands of the police or at the hands of people who, unfortunately, like Dylann Roof, who is racist, a 21-year-old individual who was very young, who did something very, very horrendous. And so I think when we try to think about the Black Lives Matter movement, let's focus on those people. If it's hard for people to connect with people who have a checkered past or may have some type of criminal record, well, let's connect with the people who died in Charleston.
Lines are jammed as we discuss a new poll showing race relations at a low point in American history, and we have calls from across the listening area. Theo is in Jacksonville. Hi, Theo. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm well. How are you this morning? In response to the last caller, I think that it's ridiculous to say something as far as lifestyles and all that stuff. I'm an African-American, and I've grown up in the African-American community. I've done better for myself. My family does better for ourselves. We're very much involved in our community and helping other people in our community. But what was sad for me to hear was the talk about rap music and all these other things. Because particularly when you listen to those lyrics, nowadays, not so much as back in the 90s, rap music is more sexual nowadays than it is violent. And I find that particular listener said a lot of things that that go against what the Black Lives Matter movement is. It's about Black Lives Matter. It doesn't matter if someone is a criminal. It doesn't matter if someone is a saint. What really matters is the fact that life was taken from someone who was unarmed and did not provoke any real pontification like that. Like no one deserves to be shot down in the street with no cause. And what my real question is, why I really called, was to see how do you feel about the All Lives Matter versus the Black Lives Matter movement?
All right, Theo, thanks. Dr. Wilder, what about that question?
Yeah, so that's been a really huge sort of counter-narrative to the Black Lives Matter movement. When you have lots of people who are saying, why are we putting the focus on Black Lives Matter? Let's talk about how all lives matter. And again, when you think about the all lives matter discourse, what that does is, again, dilute the disproportionate number of people of color, who are, negatively impacted by policing and injustice. And again, it dilutes the importance for a Black Lives Matter movement in the first place. We understand and we recognize that within the United States, it is important for us to see that all lives matter. But we have seen just in the past several years that all lives are not treated in the same way. All lives are not respected in the same way. Even the previous caller who wanted to make value judgments and give conditions on even the life of Michael Brown, when you say, oh, Michael Brown was just a criminal, that means that that life actually, well, he lost his life and maybe it was okay for him to lose his life because he was a criminal. So that really kind of talks about why Black Lives Matter is such a big movement, because people start to give value, more or less value, on certain lives. And at the core of the Black Lives Matter movement really does say that black lives, it's not saying that black lives matter more, it's saying that black lives matter too. Everyone else's lives.
Lots of tweets and emails. Chloe tweets the show, to mention rap culture is not synonymous with black culture. Kadesh tweets the show, focusing only on black crime is a diversionary tactic, like kids telling on each other to avoid getting caught. Javon emails the show, one of the problems we have with race is the way we talk about it, and particularly how we objectify issues in the black community. 86% of whites are killed by other whites. Whites use drugs just as much and sometimes more than minorities. Broken families exist in white communities, too. Law enforcement recognizes white supremacists as a bigger threat to national security even than Islamic terrorism, but we'd never talk about these issues as matters of whiteness. Thank you for all the social media feedback. Let's go to Amira in Jacksonville. Amira, good morning.
Good morning. The reason I was calling is I was also disturbed by the gentleman, I think his name was Josh, that said about Michael Brown. And the only reason that disturbed me is because it also made me think about the fact that Black Lives Matter is too inclusive. When you say Black Lives Matter, if Caucasian people or people who are non-African American immediately go to Michael Brown, that explains the divide. It should be Black Lives Matter, but at the same time, we're looking at two different sources here. We're looking at someone who was a police officer representing a whole county or a whole judicial system, versus someone who was basically a domestic terrorist that went into a church and killed innocent people. So Black Lives Matter, but we don't put it in content. It makes it easier for people who are of non-African American descent to basically say, no, it doesn't matter, because now we're talking about criminals versus church parishioners. And I want to know what the doctor thinks about that.
Thank you, Amira.
I completely agree with you. So again, I think your comment speaks directly to why there is such a divide, because A, people don't necessarily want to think about or understand how things are really reproduced on an institutionalized basis. So a lot of folks want to leave things on a very individual level. So when you think about Michael Brown's death, we want to make it about the things, the choices that particularly that some folks may think are questionable and may justify his death and may even further justify why Darren Wilson took his life in the first place. And so I think when you look at and, when people sort of pick apart the details or the things that people use to make the Black Lives Matter, less important, and you're right. So it doesn't matter that Michael Brown died in the way he did, in the same way that it doesn't matter that the folks who died at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, it doesn't necessarily matter that they were at church either. They could have been, in the same neighborhood that Michael Brown was. But again, when people think about the Black Lives Matter movement, or people call attention to the deeply embedded institutional practice of racism when it comes to the criminal justice system and other facets of our society. Many people don't want to acknowledge that. People would much rather point the finger at an individual rather than at an institution. And that's why we continue to grapple with this issue over and over, because it's not about individuals. It's about a broader system of racism, white privilege, and institutionalized racism that really is permeated throughout all our nation's institutions. And they've been that way for generations, for centuries.
Lots of emails. Deb, to the caller who said only non-criminal lives should matter, the problem with that is it's not how our justice system is supposed to work. It's not up to the policeman and a gun to determine if someone is guilty. Here's an email from David. I think what one of the previous callers failed to enunciate was that the movement made a strategic blunder in holding up Michael Brown as a martyr. Eric Garner might have been a much better person to point to in order to gain public attention. And let's go now to Robert in Arlington. Hi, Robert. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hey, 35-year listener. I used to always catch classical music with you till noon. But today, I kind of had to call in because I'm a business owner in Arlington and always trying to see Arlington flourish. And we've had some issues up and down. But went to the council meeting, the councilwoman for District 1, had a nice meeting at the Lions Club in Arlington last night, and huge turnout, like 200 people plus. And one gentleman that spoke said, hey, I noticed everyone in the audience is over 50 years old. We ought to get some youth in here. And was a nice comment. I didn't really even think about who was up front and who was in the audience until your program today. And up front, I believe our councilwoman is black. I believe our zone commander, the chief of JSO commander, was black. The gentleman from JEA, I believe, was black. I have to admit, I didn't really pay attention. I kind of wish I had heard your program today before I went, because I really wasn't keeping track. But as I was recollecting, I thought, this is interesting. We had like 200 and some over 50, mostly white audience, and everyone up front in power was black.
Yeah.
And this goes so against, that doesn't fit your storyline that you have going on here today. But, you know, politics is local. All politics is local. And, you know, what was going on there, to me, was just the way America works. I don't know that that's, you know, that doesn't fit your narrative, but
right.
I didn't even think about it until today's show. And then today's show, you know, you keep hearing about all the separation, all this diversity, you know, and it's like,
right.
I guess I just never paid attention until I started listening to academia.
Thanks, Robert. And, you know, the poll reflects how people perceive opportunities, how they perceive the criminal justice system, economic opportunities, and more. So let's talk about that. Thanks for the call, Robert. Dr. Wilder.
Yeah, so the important part to remember is that another reason why there is such a gulf in perspective and a gulf in thinking about race relations or even thinking about opportunity to get jobs is because there are some folks who have the luxury and the benefit of not having to see these things on a regular basis because it does not impact them on a regular basis. And so if something does not impact you, if you don't experience things that really limit your opportunity or provide barriers in place that limit your ability to have a good life or decent quality of life for you or your loved ones, then it becomes very, very difficult to recognize and to acknowledge that your ability to have equal opportunity is not the same as everyone else. And so that inability to see becomes that blindness, right? So we talk about this idea of racial blindness, people not necessarily recognizing the privilege they have connected to something that, you know, they didn't earn. Right. And so that becomes very, very difficult for people to talk about, acknowledge, and understand in the same way that it becomes very, very painful for people of color to constantly talk about and have countless examples of ways in which that their opportunity has been limited. And again, the caller brought up a very interesting and important point. Yes, there are many people of color in places of quote unquote power or position or influence today. That does not negate the institutionalized barriers that people of color still are disproportionately impacted by. So just because you have a Dr. Wilder who is African-American and has a PhD does not really do anything, that does not negate the fact that only, you know, 20% of Black students finish college in 4 years. So I think that's the other piece. Again, people want to justify or explain things in a very individual type of narrative when you're really missing the broader picture of the institution.
Well, we so appreciate you joining us to discuss this survey. Timely, and thanks for joining us on short notice.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Joined by Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder of UNF this morning, and much more still to come. Later, the Blood Alliance has a great offer this month. If you'll come in and donate, we'll tell you about it. But up next, cutting-edge treatment on the First Coast for patients suffering from depression, a new way to treat this. We'll tell you about it right after this.
The PBS Fall Arts Festival, airing Friday nights on WJCT, is celebrating its fifth season of bringing audiences the best in arts programming. This season includes Unity, the Latin tribute to Michael Jackson, and Danny Elfman's music from the films of Tim Burton. WJCT will host live performances from Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater and Players by the Sea on the main stage of Hemming Park during the third annual Oktoberfest Downtown Art Walk on Wednesday, October 7, beginning at 5 p.m.
Life has enough drama.
Seems we've gotten a bad batch of grits, and we think it comes from Minnesota. They've made everyone feel gloomy and guilty.
Oh. And reality.
Can we not do
all
this?
Right?
Can we
Listen,
just not do this?
I'm going to have a practice funeral. All right?
Find a way to forget your troubles.
With ping pong, trap shooting, hopscotch.
And gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion, returning Saturdays at 6.
Welcome back. Well, it's a silent public health epidemic in this country. Mental illness. Approximately 1 in 5 adults in the U.S., 43 million people, experience mental illness in a given year. Now, the first week in October marks Mental Illness Awareness Month. Sharik Rafai, MD, is a psychiatrist with Baptist Behavioral Health, and he joins us now to discuss cutting-edge brain stimulation therapy at Baptist that helps people suffering from severe depression. Dr. Rafai, good morning.
Good morning.
And this is for people that haven't had success with antidepressant meds, correct?
That's correct. People who have had multiple medication failures and suffer from major depression that's severe in nature.
Tell us about it. It's a NeuroStar TMS therapy, an outpatient procedure, and you use a pulsed magnetic field to stimulate the brain.
That's correct. So it's known as transcranial magnetic stimulation. It was FDA approved for major depression that's severe in nature, people who have had at least 3 medication failures. generally, I end up getting more failures than that. And it's FDA approved in 2008. Basically, it's an outpatient procedure. Patient comes in and there's a magnet that's placed on their head. The magnet sits on the prefrontal cortex, which is known to alter mood and control mood. Generally, what that does is it increases blood flow in that area, increases glucose metabolism, and in that fashion, it treats depression.
How does this work differently than, say, a Prozac pill or an Effexor medication or the types of similar antidepressant meds that a doctor might commonly prescribe?
So this is a non-invasive procedure. It's not anything that you have to ingest. It's not systemic. It's just basically a magnet that sits on top of your head. I mean, you don't have to go under anesthesia. You don't have to swallow anything. It's done over a period of 6 weeks. There's 30 to 36 treatments daily. It's 37 minutes long. Generally, there's no systemic side effects. Generally, the most common side effects are headache or pain in the area, which go away within the first week of treatment for the most part. People even end up sleeping on the chair.
And does it alter brain chemistry differently than antidepressants might?
Yeah, so it can cause neuroplasticity. What that means is it readjusts the brain and that readjusts that prefrontal cortex, which affects mood.
Do we know why some patients respond well to meds and others don't, which might necessitate them trying this type of therapy?
No, there's no real evidence, but generally 80% of people who do end up going through treatment with medications end up being successful with them. 50% of the ones that are unsuccessful is because of non-compliance.
It's so fascinating. This is such a fascinating field, and we're really just beginning to scratch the surface of what we know about it. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there's not really too many things out there right now. There are things that are cutting edge that they're working on, but nothing outside of just medications, and this is the newest thing to treat it.
Depression is the common cold of mental illness, as they say. So this is exciting news for Baptist Behavioral Health. You're the first medical center in the area to offer this, correct?
Right, and I have people all the way from Daytona who come in and get the treatment.
What's the result been so far for patients?
I've treated approximately maybe 30 patients, and I would say out of the 30, maybe two of them were unsuccessful. So generally, the success rate is 70% successful.
How long does it take for their depression to lift?
I've noticed a difference within 2 weeks in some, but most commonly around 4 weeks within the treatment.
So they after a few treatments, they start to feel better. That's just quite incredible.
Yeah, and it's been a huge success because there's patients who have suffered from depression for 7, 10, even 20 years and have not had any success with medications, and they came in and get the treatment, and it's just they're living a different life.
It is just amazing. The NeuroStar system, a non-invasive outpatient procedure at Baptist Behavioral Health, treating patients with severe depression. These are patients that haven't had success with antidepressant medications. Now being done on an outpatient basis. Dr. Shariq Rafai, a psychiatrist at Baptist, joining us. October does kick off Mental Illness Awareness Week, so it's timely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, for the last several decades now, at the far fringes of American evangelical Christianity has stood a movement known as Christian Reconstruction. The proponents of this movement embrace a radical position that all of life should be brought under the authority of biblical law as it is contained in both the Old and New Testaments. UNF Religious Studies Professor Julie Ingersoll explores the movement in her new book, Building God's Kingdom, Inside the World of Christian Reconstruction. I spoke with her about it. Julie Ingersoll, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here.
So in this book, you explore a segment of the Christian right known as Christian Reconstruction. Tell us about the beliefs of this portion of the movement.
Well, the founder of it, Rusus John Rushduni, wrote as early as the 1960s this strategy for applying biblical law to every area of life. And since that time, his followers have developed that strategy, kind of implemented it in a broad-based Christian education movement, and it has a lot of implications for conservatism that we see around us today.
Like what?
Well, for example, the movement for the approach to the six-day creationist account comes in large measure out of this era. Prior to the 60s, the version of creationism that was dominant was a day-age theory of creationism. The current six-day account comes from a book that Rushduni got published and is rooted in a philosophical system that Rushduni developed.
Christian Reconstructionists believe that the death penalty is justified for homosexuality, adultery, breaking the Sabbath?
They do. Their theory is that all of the biblical law described in the Hebrew Bible, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, all of that is still applicable and binding on us today. I do think it's important to focus on the things that they do that are a little less extreme, because often what happens in studies of this movement is people find those things appalling and they stop there and dismiss them as too crazy to take seriously. When in fact, I think, for example, they are profoundly opposed to public education, and they've worked for 50 years to undermine public education, to defund it, to privatize it, and to replace it. And in those areas, they're having influence. And so I think that those are much more important things to look at.
How would you say that influence is being felt?
Well, I think it's felt in the moves to privatize public education, kind of the widespread suspicion of public education. I think that 50 years ago, Americans thought of public schools as the crucible of democracy. We valued them tremendously, and these days that's not true anymore.
But do you attribute that solely to Christian Reconstructionists?
Certainly not. No. There were lots of influences that led to this. Mm-hmm. I think that this is just one of the aspects that hasn't been explored before.
Christian Reconstructionists comprise how big a portion of the evangelical movement in America?
It's very small. The actual numbers are hard to come by. And I think that the ways to look at the influence in this particular case are more to trace the lineage of ideas, to see where they find expression in places where people may not even recognize them as such. It's pretty common for people to not have a real clear picture of the intellectual movements that led to the way that they see the world. And I think Rush Dooney's influence is largely hidden.
Where are some places in the culture where the influence is more visible? In terms of well-known speakers or pundits or writers?
There are some people who explicitly identify as Christian Reconstructionists, but those are much fewer and they are less well-known. But then there are people like, for example, David Barton, who is, he promotes himself as a historian. He's kind of an amateur historian. His training is actually in education. He's been very influential in the Tea Party, thanks to Glenn Beck bringing him on the show regularly. And David Barton's work is deeply influenced by Rush Dooney.
And the Tea Party as a whole, how closely tied would you say the Tea Party is with Christian Reconstructionism?
Well, in some ways, I think very closely tied. But I think it's important with the Tea Party to remember that it isn't, we call it the Tea Party movement, but the truth is it's a loosely tied, affiliated collection of organizations that are unhappy about some shared things. So there are parts of the Tea Party that I think have been greatly influenced by the homeschool movement, and the homeschool movement has its roots in Rush Dooney. And then there are other parts of the Tea Party that I think don't have any ties to Reconstructionism.
Right. And in terms of the homeschool movement, people tend to think of homeschoolers as being religiously motivated, but not all of them are.
That's right. And I trace this out in the book a little bit. Initially, homeschooling started before the Christian influence existed, and it was largely, I call them the granola people, right? These are folks that were troubled by age-specific education, found public education to be too restrictive, and would buy land out in the country and build a farm and raise children and homeschool them. But the overwhelming majority of homeschoolers now are Christian. And many of them, though, are not Reconstructionist. In fact, there's a contingent of homeschoolers who are really upset about the influence that Christian Reconstructionists have. Mm-hmm. But it is the case that starting in the 1950s, Rush Dooney made an argument that public education is inherently unbiblical. And initially that led to the Christian school movement, and Rush Dooney was key in serving as an expert witness to establish the legal legitimacy of alternative education. And then that expanded for homeschooling and Christian homeschooling. And in many states, homeschooling is almost entirely unregulated, and that comes directly out of Rush Dooney's arguments in legal cases.
What about Florida? How is it regulated in Florida?
Just minimally so.
What do you think about that?
Religious studies scholars try to do work that is descriptive and explanatory rather than advocacy-based. My personal opinions are that I'm very supportive of public education, and I think that that's troubling. But that's a little bit separate from the academic work that I do.
In terms of the Christian right and the beliefs of people that have deeply held beliefs, what are your thoughts about the argument that so much of this movement is a backlash against just the general changes that come along with modernity?
Well, that's a great question, because for the longest time there's been a dispute among historians and religious studies scholars over whether fundamentalism is modernist or anti-modernist. And certainly in some ways they are challenged and struggling with issues associated with modernity. But in other ways, they are profoundly modern and actually even postmodern. A lot of the people, like David Barton, for example, will talk pretty frequently about his concerns over postmodernism, but he never defines it, and I'm not sure he understands what it means, because Rushdoony's fundamental framework is called presuppositionalism, which basically says that all knowledge is dependent on assumptions that aren't provable, so that you sort of have to start by making a contextual assumption. To me, that is profoundly a postmodern observation. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix.
What's the reaction to your book been, particularly from people of faith?
It's been terrific, actually. I'm having a lot of fun. As you know, because you've looked at it, this is a book that's really 30 years in the making. It's not my first academic book, but it's my first academic book as an established scholar. And when you work on something that long, first of all, it's hard to let it go, right? But I've had some great reviews. I've had some reviews from people in the homeschooling community who are really happy about one of the things I try really hard to do is to dial back the hostility of the rhetoric and acknowledge the complexity within the movements that I talk about. And I think, for example, homeschoolers sometimes feel like when someone says that Reconstructionism is an important influence, sometimes they feel like they're painted with a broad brush that says that they're all Reconstructionists. And I try to be really careful not to do that. So far, the reception has been wonderful, and it's a lot of fun.
Julie Ingersoll, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
UNF's Julie Ingersoll is a professor of religious studies. Her new book is Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstruction.
And finally this hour, here's a deal for you. Give a little blood and enjoy a free taste of fall. The Blood Alliance will give the first 1,500 donors who give blood during the first 10 days of October a pair of free tickets to Jackstoberfest coming up next weekend at the St. John's Town Center. Spokeswoman Odette Stroys of the Blood Alliance is here to tell us more. Also, WJCT's own Andrew Wickman is here to tell us about our own blood drive. Hi, guys.
Hi. You know, if you enjoy pumpkin bowling or...
I do, in fact. I live for pumpkin bowling.
Or bratwurst eating competitions. Or if you have a wiener dog like I have, too, you want to put them in a wiener race at Jackstoberfest.
Of course.
And last year, they had about 55,000 people, you know, at the shipyards. But this year, it's at the town center, and the Blood Alliance has teamed up with them to say, look, come out and give blood. First 10 days, 1,500 people, while our supplies last, will get two tickets to Jackstoberfest Saturday. So come on out and give blood. It's a good thing. You're going to save lives.
That's right. Just make an appointment. You can go to igiveblood.com, or mm-hmm. you even have an app. People can go to your app to...
I donate. IDON and the number 8. Mm-hmm. I donate. And you can, you know, everyone says, well, what are we going to do in October? We're going to give you a free t-shirt throughout the entire month of October to celebrate being frightful. It's that Halloween thing, you know, and on the 26th of October, you can actually come here, meet Melissa and everybody else. You know, you sit and you listen to them all the time. Come on down to WJCT. They have their own blood drive.
That's right, Andrew. Let's talk about it.
That's right. On October 26th from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m., right after lunch, right after you're fed and well hydrated, come on by the WJCT studios outside in our parking lot. We will have a Blood Alliance truck. We need 15 and plus donors. It only takes less than an hour. Come on by. If you just want to find out what blood type you are, come on by.
And yeah, and you
find
get,
out. You never
you
know.
You'll meet everyone. You'll meet Andy and Melissa and everyone else. So it's October 26th. Come out here. You'll get your free Frightful Got Blood t-shirt.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to be at least 110 pounds, about 17 years old, and just be in general good health, hydrated, have a good meal. Come on down and see us.
Absolutely, because you are the only blood supplier for all the hospitals in the region, and you always need donors, Odette.
Every single day our need is constant because blood is a perishable product. So when someone gives blood, they go, well, I've done my duty. Well, it's already gone. Your most important donation is your next one. And we ask everyone, please remember this, share your power. You have the gift of giving life. Use it, and use it ahead of time, not after the fact. So always make sure our blood shelves are filled and stocked with a good supply. You need to come out and actually do something like give blood. And then, you know, when someone needs it and, you know, It could be someone you even know yourself. It will be there for you. So please don't wait for a catastrophe to happen. Do it now.
And it's important to mention that the blood collected by the Blood Alliance stays in our community
Correct.
To treat local patients.
It is a local community, the only provider of blood.
So a couple of opportunities. You can come to WJCT on the afternoon of October 26th and donate. The Blood Mobile will be here. Or
2:30 to 4:30.
Or if you start, if you sign up and give blood through the first week in October.
The first 10 days.
First 10 days, Odette will make sure you get a couple of free tickets to Jackstoberfest. That's coming up Saturday, October 10th at the St. John's Town Center.
And everyone throughout October gets a Got Blood Frightful Halloween t-shirt. So please come out and give blood. You're going to do a great job of saving three lives in just an hour. How wonderful.
It's a deal you can't pass up. Thanks, guys, so much.
If you need information on donating, go to igiveblood.com to schedule your appointment now.
Igiveblood.com. Do it now. Odette Stroys with the Blood Alliance. Andrew Wickman of WJCT joining us. Igiveblood.com. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have questions or comments, we always want to hear them. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a program. Make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, this week President Obama addresses the UN General Assembly and meets with world leaders, including Russian President Vladimir Putin. A look at new tests for U.S. leadership, prospects for cooperation in Syria, and the fight against ISIS. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.